coming up on the My Ag Life Daily News Report. We have a focus on trade today with a panel discussion from the Atlantic Council. In a segment for today, we have an, in case you missed it, interview on exciting new research into HLB for citrus. To start, trade talks are underway between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada as part of a two-day summit regarding the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. The agreement is nearing its first anniversary, and there are a handful of issues of concern. Politico reports there are continuing labor concerns between the U.S. and Mexico, and trade barriers in place by Mexico and Canada. Farm groups have concerns over recent policies by Mexico, including decisions against genetically modified corn and the use of glyphosate, along with concerns over a new Mexican food labeling law aimed at combating obesity. Meanwhile, Monday, the former acting deputy U.S. Trade Representative Wendy Cutler spoke about trade policy with the Atlantic Council. It starts with Christopher Preble, the Atlantic Council New American Engagement co-director.
Today, we are thrilled to welcome Wendy Cutler, Vice President at the Asia Society Policy Institute, in conversation with Nick Wadhams, Senior Foreign Policy Reporter at Bloomberg News, on the future of U.S. trade policy. Ms. Cutler is uniquely qualified to speak on this topic. She led negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and served nearly three decades as a diplomat and negotiator in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Wendy also possesses deep knowledge of East Asia, which is of particular importance given its centrality to the global economy. As for Nick Wadhams, he has written extensively on U.S. policy towards China, including on issues related to trade and commerce. Wendy and Nick, thank you again for sharing your expertise with us today. As the United States slowly emerges from our COVID-induced coma and the U.S. economy begins to pick up, this is the perfect moment to discuss the state of U.S. trade strategy and how U.S. trade relations fit into the Biden administration's broader foreign policy. I'm particularly interested to know what a successful and sustainable U.S. trade policy would look like in light of the Biden administration's pledge to pursue a foreign policy for the middle class. Can we also have a trade policy for the middle class? I look forward to hearing Wendy's thoughts on this matter. And lastly, before I forget, thank you, viewers, for joining us for this event. If you have a question you'd like to ask Wendy, please submit using the Q&A function on Zoom or tweet your question to @ACScowcroft. And with that, over to you, Nick.
Chris, thanks very much. Wendy, very excited to speak with you today. And I have all sorts of questions for you. But first, I wanted to start off with a little bit of breaking news. Earlier today, China announced that it was extending some tariff exclusions for U.S. imports for a certain set of imports, including some rare earths ore and gold ore. At the same time, you had the U.S. and the EU both announcing in a statement that they were going to put new pressure on China. They said they want to hold countries like China that support trade-distorting policies to account. So you have two new messages today that seem to run slightly counter to each other. And I was just hoping we could start by having you put these two statements in their proper context. And particularly, my question on the China announcement is, does this signal a sort of concession from China or perhaps an olive branch to the United States to start a new round of trade talks?
Well, thanks, Nick, and you're right. It's been a busy day already today on the trade front. So let's start with the China announcement. I mean, I think it's a welcome development, but I would not read too much into it for two reasons. First, the exclusions that have been extended over a longer time frame by China apply to a limited number of products. I think it's 79 products out of thousands or tens of thousands of products on which tariffs are already applied. And second, I haven't seen the list, but I'm assuming these are products that are in the interest of China to relax the tariffs on. Because despite what President Trump said, it's the importers, it's China that's paying the tariffs that it's imposing against US imports. And so again, welcome development, but I wouldn't read too much into it. Now, with respect to the announcement, the joint announcement by USTR Tai, Secretary of Commerce, and the EU Trade Commissioner, I think that's a welcome announcement, but also no surprises here. The key action forcing reason for this announcement was that the EU was poised to increase their tariffs against US imports on June 1. And through this announcement, they have said they're going to suspend those tariffs as both sides try to work on a solution with respect to global overcapacity on steel and aluminum.
Okay, so taking it sort of from the more granular approach to a 30,000 foot level, do you see this administration sharpening its trade policy toward China? Do you see a more coherent policy emerging, a little more meat on the bone? Catherine Tai has said she wants to meet with her counterpart from China at some point relatively soon. We don't have a date for that yet. So are you seeing that policy take shape both for China and more broadly for the Asia Pacific, or do you think they're still working through it?
Well, clearly the Biden administration's trade policy is still a work in progress. And let's be honest, the focus is really on domestic issues right now, whether it be COVID recovery or economic recovery or infrastructure. And so I think we're seeing the most movement on trade in areas where trade aligns very closely with these domestic priorities. So whether it be climate change or COVID recovery or supply chains, that's where we're seeing kind of the most traction. But that said, I also think we're seeing a much more kind of thoughtful policy already, one that's based on working with allies and partners, with the administration seemingly in no rush to engage with China until they really figure out their overall policy, with the trade component being one part of an overall strategic policy towards China.
It's interesting that you mentioned the allies and partners, because this has really struck me as one element that's a fundamental tension in the trade policy that the Biden administration has articulated so far, where on the one hand, they say repeatedly, both on trade and foreign policy, and essentially every aspect of their approach to the world, is that we want to work with allies and partners. Yet at the same time, the president himself, in his speech to Congress, said, "Hey, buy American," and he was very explicit that he sees competition in the 21st century as a real battle royale almost with China, that these are two systems working for supremacy in the world. So how do you think that this administration will resolve what appears to be that tension, where obviously working with allies and partners would seem to lead you down one avenue for a particular trade strategy, but if you're then turning around and telling Congress and the world to buy American, that's something that would seemingly alienate or potentially be an avenue of concern for allies and partners.
And that's a great question. And I agree with you. I think there is some built-in tension here, whether it be the administration pushing for reshoring of jobs back to the United States, or whether it's with respect to pursuing Buy American policies. So the administration's going to have to navigate very carefully and make sure that in doing so, it doesn't alienate our allies and partners. And that can be done. For example, on Buy America, we have certain obligations to our trading partners, but most of our government procurement is not covered by international obligations. So with respect to those non-covered procurements, we can opt, the Buy America restrictions. The question is, will we then cross over into those areas where we are now obligated to open those purchases up to foreign governments and foreign companies from those governments? And so that will have to be carefully navigated. I think the steel announcement that was made today also kind of underscores this underlying tension, although I think the both sides were able to find a way forward, at least for now. And that is, again, that the EU agreed not to go ahead with tariff increases, but the US committed to working with Europe to find a solution to the real problem that led to the tariffs, and that is global overcapacity. They've given themselves, I think, to the end of the year to work out a solution on steel and aluminum with the EU, and we'll have to see how those negotiations proceed.
We will continue with trade in segment 3, but our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
Agrimayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agrimayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agrimayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today. Virtual swearing-in ceremonies were held Monday for the Agriculture Department's new Deputy Secretary. Rod Vain reports.
A virtual ceremony Monday.
And that I will well and faithfully.
And that I will well and faithfully.
Discharge the duties of the office.
Discharge the duties of the office.
On which I am about to enter.
On which I am about to enter.
In which Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack administered the oath of office to the new Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Jewel Brenaud.
We are pleased and honored to welcome you to the USDA family, an historic moment for the department, and certainly a historic moment for you and your family. Well deserved, and we are incredibly proud to have you as part of our team.
Thank you.
The Deputy Secretary said after taking the oath,
I take this position very seriously. I am honored to serve in this position and very excited about serving those who really rely on USDA for their lives and their livelihood.
With Secretary Vilsack adding,
you will play a major role in leading one of the great departments of the federal government.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Average sales prices for high-quality land in many states are at or near the peak prices last seen in January of 2014. That according to Farmers National Company's internal estimates to be released in June. Land values have taken a sizable jump in the past 6 months, and the new levels reflect that move. For instance, the company says the June 2021 value for Illinois will be $12,300 per acre versus $12,500 per acre in January 2014. The estimated price per acre in Arkansas was $5,000 at the start of 2014 and is now at $5,600. Ohio was $8,000 per acre and is now at $8,150 per acre. We hear about plans for a more resilient food system, but what does that mean? Stephanie Ho looks into it.
What does USDA mean when it talks about building a more resilient food system?
The COVID pandemic showed to us that we have a brittle food system that can't really withstand a lot of shock to it. And so what we want to do is rebuild our food system into one that is resilient.
Mei Wu is Deputy Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs.
What we really need to do is rebuild it into something that can withstand the next crisis, whatever it is. And so that's why we need to look at all the parts where we saw the breakdown happen.
Some of the areas include,
what can we do to develop a supply chain that can sustain with critical processing and infrastructure capacity? We need to look at how we maintain the availability and the integrity of all the goods and products and services that are associated with agriculture and getting food to people.
Another issue is providing equitable access to the food system for diverse communities. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service projections for farm profits are mixed through 2030. USDA ERS provides forecasts for net cash farm income and net farm income, two major profitability indicators of the agricultural sector. Net farm income is a broader measure of the farm sector profitability that incorporates non-cash items. Net cash farm income includes only gross cash income minus all cash expenses. For last year, ERS forecast net farm income to be at $123 billion, which was $31 billion more than the 20-year average, and net farm income at $139 billion. A group of farm and livestock organizations met last week to find ways to improve cattle market transparency. Michael Clements shares some of the discussion.
Six agriculture groups recently held a discussion on the current state of cattle markets. The meeting included the American Farm Bureau Federation, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, RCAF, U.S. Cattlemen's Association, National Farmers Union, and the Livestock Marketing Association. Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall calls the meeting an unprecedented event.
I've been president of American Farm Bureau for 5 years, and at no time in those 5 years have all six of these organizations met together. So I was excited about us getting together and talking about what we could do in the future to help our cattle feeders and our cow-calf producers and to make sure that they get treated fairly and have access to transparent marketing systems.
Through the discussion, Duvall says the groups identified three main areas of concern.
One of those areas is packer capacity and concentration. We are interested in seeing new investments in regional small and medium-sized processors. Price transparency and discovery is also another concern, and market oversight. We have a Packers and Stockyard Act, and we want to make sure that it's enforced. That act was put there to make sure that everybody from the birth of the calf to the time it's harvested and reached the shelf is treated fairly.
Moving forward, Duvall hopes for more discussions in the future.
Well, I surely hope that we'll have not just one more meeting, but many meetings of those groups. We want to continue to dialogue to pursue a fair and transparent livestock marketing system. And we also, as individual groups with members that set policy, we want to make sure that we take our discussion back to our respective organizations so that we can continue to work for our farmers and ranchers across America.
Learn more at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
That's our news brief for today. We continue the focus on trade right after this.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
We go back now to the conversation on trade, hosted by the Atlantic Council and also presented on the C-SPAN website. Bloomberg's senior foreign policy reporter Nick Wadhams discussing trade policy with Wendy Cutler, vice president of the Asian Society Policy Institute.
Now, do you see in your conversations and given your experience having negotiated some extremely thorny trade issues in the past, you know, it really strikes me that in the Trump administration, the president often used tariffs almost as a coercive measure or a weapon to say, okay, give us what we want, and if you don't, I'm going to slap tariffs on you. That was certainly the case with Turkey. You saw that obviously with the European Union and France. Is there a loss of trust there that the Biden administration simply won't be able to restore? It felt a little like the Trump administration was opening a Pandora's box where trade and tariffs were being used in new and innovative and potentially hostile ways. Is there enough trust to be able to negotiate some of these really thorny trade issues that were likely to, even when the negotiations are likely to last years, you know, potentially through 2024 into a new administration?
Well, I think you put your finger on a great issue, and that is trust. And rebuilding trust takes time. And, you know, we have a 4-year presidential election cycle. And so the Biden team obviously is working very hard to restore our alliances, to rebuild trust, to re-enter and show leadership in some key international organizations. And I think a lot of our allies and partners welcome this, but also I think in the back of their minds, there's also kind of an uneasiness about where the United States might be in 3.5 years. So I think that has led a lot of our allies and partners to really work on diversifying their trading partners and their economic partners so they're not over-reliant on the United States should we, in 3.5 years, embark on a protectionist, you know, trade policy.
Well, that leads me actually right into my next question. And I know you had spent a lot of time working on this issue of a foreign policy for the middle class. In my conversations with administration officials, they've been very clear to try to differentiate between foreign policy for the American middle class and America First, and try to assuage concerns that a foreign policy for the middle class would essentially amount to protectionism. How do you differentiate the two? Do you see a distinction, or do you understand, or have you spoken to other officials from other countries about their concerns that essentially a foreign policy for the middle class could amount to protectionism?
Yes, and I have had these conversations, and a number of countries do, you know, have expressed to me a concern. Does this mean protectionism? Does this mean, you know, buy America? Does this mean reshoring? Are we going to see more tariffs? And what I tried to explain to them, having been a member of the task force that worked on this Carnegie report for a number of years, that this approach is more about building domestic support in the United States for an international economic engagement strategy. And if we can build that support, we're going to be much more effective on the international scene. And again, I think there is a way to pursue a worker-centric trade policy or a trade policy for the middle class without resorting to protectionism. That will be clearly, you know, some folks in certain agencies may lean towards protectionist measures. But again, I think there's a way to do both at the same time, but it needs to be done very skillfully and in close consultation with our allies and partners.
That's very interesting, because it seems like one of the big test cases for that will be in the Indo-Pacific and what this administration decides to do around the TPP, or potentially trying to resuscitate its participation in some form of trade agreement across the Indo-Pacific region. Can you just give us a sense of where you see this administration headed? What can the U.S. really be doing in Asia short of rejoining the TPP?
Well, as much as I would personally like to see the United States return to some kind of TPP, and I recognize that if we were to return, it can't be the agreement as is. Updates would need to be made, revisions would need to be made, but I just don't think it's in the cards right now. And so I'm a pragmatic person, and my, you know, my feeling is we should now be pursuing narrower sectoral regional deals, get us back in the game in Asia, whether it be digital trade or secure supply chains or climate and trade. Let's try and do some narrower initiatives where we would not need congressional approval. And these, if successful, could be impactful in the region and may actually serve as building blocks towards an eventual return of the United States to some TPP-like agreement.
It's, I guess the challenge there is that on the one hand, you have obviously former President Trump, and then the left wing of the Democratic Party that was really pretty vehemently opposed to TPP. And then you have a fair number of Republicans, a great number of Republicans, and then some Democrats who also believe that there's a future for it. So are you still holding out hope that in some number of years' time, we could actually get back to a TPP-like formulation for the U.S. trade policy in the region?
I think it's doable, but again, I'm also realistic and I understand the challenges, and I just don't see it happening now or next year, or possibly not even within the next 4 years. But then again, that doesn't mean we can't engage. And so I think, you know, for me, I think it's so critical that the Biden team get back in the region economically by pursuing a more limited type of deal.
Right.
I think if we wait too long, we're going to find ourselves increasingly on the outside as other countries, including China, but not just China, other countries write the rules without us. And we saw that in the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Not only did they write rules among the 15 countries, but they now have a framework for addressing new issues as they appear in the region. And guess what? We're not going to be invited to that table for those discussions. And right. That's problematic. That's a great concern to me, and I hope to others. And I hope that shows and demonstrates that we need to find a way to engage.
So I want to turn to the USMCA, but before I do that, I want to ask you one more question about China. A huge priority for this administration has been its supply chain review, and this is still underway, an extremely complicated process that seems to boil down in large part to how the U.S. can reorient its supply chain away from China on all sorts of products. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how realistic you think it is that the U.S. could essentially decouple from the world's second biggest or soon to be largest economy in the world. Do you think that decoupling the way that this administration or the Trump administration envisioned it is even possible given the degree to which these two economies are so intertwined? And as you mentioned, there are so many other countries in the world that are not interested in picking sides, that basically want to do business both with the United States and with China.
Mm-hmm. So my view is that probably the way to go forward is what I would call selective decoupling. I think in certain technologies and other certain critical or essential products, some type of decoupling might be needed, but I think it's unrealistic to pursue a broad decoupling strategy, particularly as you mentioned, when our allies and partners, they're not there with us. For most of them, China is their largest trading partner. And let's remember, China's now the engine of growth in the Asia Pacific region. So if anything, other countries in Asia are integrating more fully with China. Now, that said, some do have concerns about being overly reliant on China, and in that regard are pursuing policies to attract some of the investment that is leaving China, as well as rewarding some of their companies or providing incentives for them to come home or to diversify their supply chains. So I would hope in the outcome of the supply chain reports for four key products that is expected, I guess, next month, that in addition to the United States providing some incentives for reshoring, we'll also see a focus on establishing secure supply chains, working with like-minded countries, and this coalition of countries could vary sector by sector or product by product, depending on which companies from which countries are involved in these technologies or in these products. And that would be kind of a key component of our supply chain policy. But, you know, a policy that is based on decoupling or reshoring is just not realistic. It's not going to happen. Our companies are not going to do that. So I hope we're smart and nuanced and really use the leverage of working with other like-minded countries to achieve our objectives.
You can get that conversation in full from the Atlantic Council or C-SPAN. I talk with a researcher about HLB right after this.
Thank you. Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. Penn State and USDA researchers have found a method for early detection of Wonglong bean disease in citrus. I spoke on the phone recently with the head of the research project and professor at Penn State University, Yinong Yang. Here's our conversation.
I am very interested in the research that was done. As we know, Wonglong bean disease can be detrimental to citrus and has already caused so much damage to citrus around the world and here in the U.S. So tell me a little bit about the research.
Okay, so this particular research is used a technology called CRISPR-Cas as a diagnostic tool to detect citrus greening pathogen.
Okay, and when you're detecting the pathogen, how difficult is that?
So what happened is that citrus greening pathogen, it's also called a CLAS, which is the abbreviation for Lepidobacter, Candida, that's the Lepidobacter asiatics, which is a disease that caused major problems in Florida and also now starting in California. And so CLAS present in extremely low level, so it's very difficult to detect until the symptoms show up and then you have the disease kind of devastating the trees. So it's very crucial to detect at the early stage you can eradicate the infected citrus plant. And we thought that CRISPR-Cas, because its capability to detect pathogen DNA at extremely low level, which in our study show it's less than 10 to the minus 18, it's about 100 or 1,000 times more sensitive than the typical commonly used quantitative PCR or qPCR. So we thought that might be a very good tool for early detection of the citrus greening disease.
And as mentioned, early detection of the citrus greening can be very important. If it is detected early, what can be done from that point?
So if it's detected early, a lot of cases is pretty much you will eradicate, you will remove the tree. Especially, let's say, in California. In Florida, it might be a little bit too late because most of the trees are infected. But in California, once you detect it, you want to basically remove the tree out of the grove.
Right, because the primary focus is to keep it from spreading to more trees,
right.
Correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So how does the CRISPR-Cas technology work? How does that actually work to detect the bacterium?
So CRISPR-Cas typically is used for genome editing. So my lab has been working on using CRISPR and developed improving the tool of CRISPR technology for the last 7-8 years. And so we actually published one of the earliest paper on plant genome editing using CRISPR. But last couple of years, we also use CRISPR as a diagnostic tool for detect pathogen DNAs. So that's part of work related to our diagnostic efforts. And in this particular case, we're using a platform called a detector, which is developed by a scientist at the University of California. In fact, the lab, Jennifer Doudna's lab, Jennifer received a Nobel Prize for 2010, Tente, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. So their lab developed this original methodology using a Cas protein variant called Cas12a. And we basically adapt this method and modify and use for detect six screening pathogen.
So how long did this research take?
How long it takes? Well, for us, it's already been up to 2 years. But I think, that's partly because my student working on multiple projects. It could be less time. Obviously, the detection itself is very quick. It only take, 1 to 2 hours. But hopefully we can further reduce the time required for if using the strip method. We could simplify the DNA extraction process. There are some DNA extraction process can be done in, 1 minute. And also then the detection maybe take another 30 minutes. So it could be every done within 1 hour. And the advantage of this methodology is it could be modified that you can do without any instrument. So it's instrument free. And if using the lateral flow strip, it's like just like pregnancy test strip, and then it can be done in the field. So it's field deployable.
So that makes it extremely useful because obviously you're dealing with citrus trees. And if you test one in the field, you might want to go to a neighboring field to test as well. And if you're getting results that quickly, it seems like that would be extremely useful. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I thought. In fact, I have been working citrus many years ago. My PhD was on studying citrus canker pathogen. So I do familiar with citrus. In fact, I have been studying citrus back before I came to U.S. My first English publication was in citrography. That was in 1987. So from 1982 to 1994, I basically worked on citrus. But after 1994, I really never work on citrus until just a couple of years ago. We're doing this small project on citrus screening diagnostics.
So it seems like this research is very impressive, and I think it's going to be a big benefit to the citrus industry. What is it that you would hope that our citrus industry listeners really get from this?
Yeah, I hope that we can further simplify and improve the methodology. Then it will be able to use practically in the field for the early detection. I mean, there's still some improvement needed in order to be used practically in the field.
Okay. And so will your team continue working on that, or will that go into the hands of other researchers?
So we hope maybe go to apply for some funding, get some funding. In fact, my current study, I don't really receive any specific grant to do that. It was kind of out of my personal interest, partly because my lab have been working on CRISPR-Cas for many years, and we do have expertise on that. So I thought it was kind of interesting to adapt this method and to see if that method works for sensitive detection. I never really apply a grant, or receive a grant, particular grant related to this study. We thought maybe if we have some funding to continue to work on, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm sure that thousands of citrus growers agree that would be great to have a grant continue.
Yeah.
Thank you again to Yinong Yang. That's our show for today. As always, we'll continue to watch over the situations that are important to California's agriculture. If you have a topic you'd like for us to cover, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.